We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses, people that were once in your shoes. Our TSBC alumni, speakers, and friends will shed light on growth strategies, resources, and inspiration to help you scale your creative business. Hey friends, when we started Proof to Product in May 2017, I had no idea what an amazing journey we were embarking on. Over the last year and a half, we've told almost 100 startup stories. These are stories from entrepreneurs just like you who are making physical products. We have talked about successes and struggles, mindset shifts, and the importance of taking action to reach your goals. Now, we're quickly approaching our 100th episode of Proof to Product, and we want to do something special to celebrate all of you, our listeners. We want to hear your story and share it with our audience. So to participate, head over to bit.ly/PTP100 and leave us a voicemail message telling us how Proof to Product has helped you in your business. Be sure to leave your name and your company name so that we can link you in our show notes too. And that's all lowercase, bit.ly/PTP100. Thank you so much for listening and sharing Proof to Product with your friends. I look forward to hearing and sharing your story. Hey friends, I'm Katie Hunt and welcome to Proof to Product. I am excited for you to hear today's interview with Paul Jarvis. He is the author of a book called Company of One, Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business. I read his book over the winter break, and so much of what Paul talks about resonated with me. We live in a world right now where we are conditioned as entrepreneurs to strive for more. That could be more revenue, more product, more customers, more followers, more visibility, and more notoriety within our own industry. And I know this is something that many of us struggle with. How do we grow strong, sustainable businesses that are profitable in a way that feels good to us, where we're not working all hours of the day? Well, through Paul's book, Company of One, and during today's interview, Paul encourages us to think differently about business growth and the choices that we make in our own companies. On today's episode, we're talking about why being a solopreneur does not mean that you're working alone, and why each of us need to know what our enough is. Hey, Paul, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. I read your book in like 2 days flat. Company of One was excellent. So let's start off with kind of a bigger question. Why is bigger not always better in business?
Yeah, I think that's what we're told. Like that's what we're told in the media. Sure. That's kind of what everybody says is that, oh, if your business does well, you should grow. Mm-hmm. If your business does well, you should hire a whole bunch of people. If your business does well, you should increase your expenses as your revenue increases. And I've always been of the mind that how about we don't do that if we don't want to? Because I don't think that it always makes sense. I think that for most business owners, we work for ourselves because we want to make the decisions. So I don't want somebody else to make decisions for me. I really think that success is personal. So if I'm chasing somebody else's version of what success looks like, at best, I'll end up with their version of success and I better hope I like it. And at worst, I've failed at something that I didn't actually want in the first place. So is that even really a failure? So right. I think that small can be better because it can be less stress, less responsibility, less resources required, quicker to get to profitability every month. I think bigger is just a lot more fragile than people think it is. And being smaller and more agile just makes a whole lot of sense a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you. So I mentioned that you've written a book called Company of One, Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business. Why was it important for you to write this book?
I wanted more people to be talking about this, to be honest. Like, I just felt like there's a singular narrative in the entrepreneurial space about growth and success and growth hacking and 10xing and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's not me. I don't run my business like that. I've been in business for 20 years. I've never wanted to do something like that. And I feel like we'd be doing entrepreneurs of the future a great disservice if they were shown or told that, hey, there's one way to do business and this is it. And if you don't want to do business in this way, then maybe you shouldn't be an entrepreneur. When really, that's not the case. That's so not the case. So I think this book is really needed because it just shares a different story. Like, I don't even think the Company of One method is right for everybody, which is weird for a nonfiction author to say, but like,
no,
I don't think it's right for everybody. I just think it's a different option for some people that would work for some people.
I agree with you. It's a different strategy. And I'm not mm-hmm. knocking your strategy, but I feel that way about the programming that we do and the education we provide. You know, yeah. I'm going to tell you everything there is to know about selling wholesale and all these other things that we teach, but you may decide that that's not right for you. And it's just, I want you to be informed and educated so that you can make the best decisions possible for your business.
Exactly. And that's really what the book is. There's no, I like to tell people there's no answers in the book. There's just really good questions that you can ask yourself about your business to make better decisions.
Absolutely. I found myself nodding my head a lot of around your different stories you were telling. And you do a great job of providing examples for how different people are connecting with the concept of Company of One and how that is defined differently in different people's businesses. So how do you personally define Company of One and what does that look like on your team?
Yeah, I think that it just like Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week isn't meant to be taken literally and be like, well, you work 4 hours a week and then you're finished. Mm-hmm. And Company of One isn't necessarily that you have a one person business. I mean, I don't. A lot. I think it's very hard to run a one-person business. Everybody mm-hmm. needs things like accountants or bookkeepers or possibly lawyers sometimes, where they're not employees, but you definitely need to lean on other people sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I think Company of One is more of like a mindset where people challenge the idea and are free to make the decision about whether or not growth makes sense, because sometimes it does and sometimes it kind of doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really the main thing. And for me, I'm not really good at managing people, to be honest. And I actually don't really like managing people. So I've never mm-hmm. wanted to promote myself out of a job I really like doing and into a job where I'm managing people doing the job that I really like doing. Yeah. So I've never wanted to grow a bigger business. Like I actually really like doing the work. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to stop doing, like I like doing writing, I like doing design. So I don't want to ever stop doing that. So I've never wanted to have a business where I was like in charge of designers or writers doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's a common problem that my audience has where they start these, most of them are artists. They're making, you know, physical products that are very creative and they start to grow. They start to have higher demand on their time because they're doing different things, creating new products. You know, to your point, they need to do their books and different legal things, you know, all the things that go into running our businesses, right? And they find that their role kind of shifts to this manager position rather than the artist position. And most of them just want to continue doing the creative work. So what advice do you have for those types of people? Like, do you recommend that they outsource some of the things that they don't want to be doing, or how do they decide what to outsource in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think about the task and I think about, is this something that it would benefit me to know how to do? Mm-hmm. Is this something I actually like doing? Is this something that I could, this a skill that I could foster to use in the future? For things like legal, like I don't want to go become a lawyer.
You don't want to spend time and money going to law school.
No. So like, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to learn how to file, but I would need to go to school to become a CA or CPA or whatever to file my mm-hmm. taxes because I'm a corporation. And in the country I live in, you need to have a certification to file taxes for a corporation. I don't want to do that. So mm-hmm. that's easy for me to outsource. But then there's other things, like I have an editor and a copy editor because I don't think the job of a writer is to write perfectly. I think the job of a writer is to share ideas. So I don't mm-hmm. want to edit my work. And I'm also really bad at it. And I have a hard time with it. Like it's very hard to find typos and mistakes. Mm-hmm. But if I sent out an article with typos and mistakes, I'd get hundreds of emails from people complaining that there's typos and mistakes.
Right.
So I hire somebody to do that. Same with podcast editing. I know how to do. My background is in music. I was a touring and studio musician for a long mm-hmm. time. So I know how to do audio work, but it's not a skill that I really want to foster. And it's not a skill that I can, like, it's not the best use of my time. I would rather be recording audio and hosting a show than editing it. So I'm happy to pay somebody else to do that. So it's always like a personal decision of like, is this a skill that I can use? Is this a skill I want to have? Is this a skill that helps anything else in my business? And if it's not, and I can afford to outsource it, because sometimes things are too expensive to outsource, then you have to do the work.
Right, but you have to figure it out.
Yeah, but if the option is there where it's like, I can afford a copy editor, I can afford a podcast engineer because I have sponsors for my show, mm-hmm. then I'm definitely willing to do that.
Yeah. I agree. I ask myself the same types of questions. You know, is this something that's the best use of my time? Is this something that I'm knowledgeable about? Or am I going to have to spend hours and hours trying to figure it out when I could just hire somebody to help me figure it out? You know, I think there's also a misconception around hiring and people thinking that if they're going to hire, it has to be a full-time employee with benefits and, you know, keeping them busy for full, you know, it's like a bigger thing when in fact, there's a lot of people that are freelancers or contractors for small amounts of hours and it's not too costly.
Yeah. And I would never I would never want to be solely responsible for an employee. Yeah. Like that's not a responsibility that I would ever want to take on. Right. I would feel like, oh my goodness, like what if their kids are in school and like we have a bad couple months and I have to let them go and they have a more, like, this is too much responsibility. Yeah. So, but everybody that I hire, like you said, they're freelancers and I even pay them like top of market rates because like I said, I don't want to manage them. So I'm not going to hire somebody for $5 an hour off of Fiverr. I would rather find the best person that can do the job with no management. I don't need to manage them. I just basically need to talk like my copy editor. We communicate in emojis. So I share a Google Doc with him with an article. He sends me like the thumbs up when he starts and the like hand clap when he's done. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I don't like, unless there's a question, unless we need to communicate because there's a question or a problem, we don't. And I don't have to manage. I don't have to manage anybody. I'm not responsible. He works with other people when he's not working with me, which is such a load off of my like cognitive responsibility load not have to be solely responsible.
You're completely speaking my language. I believe wholeheartedly in hiring experts, people that can do the work, you know, obviously to a contractor, we're not supposed to be training them on the job necessarily, you know, but I believe in hiring people that are smarter than me that can like improve upon what I already know or teach me things in the process.
Yeah. And in that case, for me, it's really easy to hire people smarter than me. But yeah, I mean, like I come from
yourself short, Paul.
But I come from a service-based background. Like I did web design for 15 years. So I've been on the other side of that. So I always know that like it's worth the money to pay the best people. Absolutely. And it's worth it to try. I always try to be their best client. Like I'll get an invoice and I'll get an invoice and I'll be like, I got to pay this in like 5 minutes or less because like I know how important that is. When I've been on the other side of that and been like, oh, it's been like 2 weeks, people, can you pay my bill now?
Or even just being prepared for those people, right? Exactly. Like having everything ready for them.
Yep, having a process, having a system, just saying like, this is how we need to do the work. If you have a question, talk to me. If not, I'm assuming you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Cool. Well, in your book, you talk about being a minimalist business and you have a section that really resonated with me. It was about knowing you're enough. And we've kind of alluded to this already, but as a business owner, it is so easy to get caught up in the grandeur of scaling and growing. And we get excited about creating new products or services and doing the art that we do. But I feel like sometimes people aren't always thinking about how those new items fit into their bigger business strategy. And as you've already said, sometimes adding more isn't what we need to be doing. So first, can you tell us how you define a minimalist business? And then I'd like to kind of talk about your philosophies around knowing you're enough.
Yeah. So if for me, I think minimalism isn't about having like no stuff or living in a tiny house. I'm really claustrophobic, so I really couldn't live in a tiny house, but I would rather live in a normal size house and have less stuff in it. So I think minimalism for me is figuring out what's needed and cutting out what's not. Mm-hmm. And that makes so much sense in business as well. Oh, yeah. I would rather, like, for example, a lot of businesses focus on like gross revenue, which I think is you need to actually have revenue. But I think not enough businesses focus on profit and how the bottom number can increase or decrease profit. So if you have less expenses, you can make the same amount of money, but bring home more because you're more profitable if you cut as many expenses as possible out. So I'm always looking at that. Like, what can I, like, how can I be as lean as possible, but still comfortable? Just like in my life, like, how can I have a mortgage that's like reasonable enough that I have a house that I'm comfortable in, but it's not so high that I'm like worried every month, like, well, am I going to be able to make this payment or not?
Right.
And so in business, it's kind of the same thing. Like I want to figure out like how to make things, like running a business is hard.
Oh,
like,
sure is.
It's really, really hard. So anything that I can make easy or take off my plate is better. So I like to always come up with things that are replicable and simple. So for anything that I do where I have to do it more than once, I try to come up with like a system or a process for it where it's not necessarily like, here's the manual, like slammed down on a desk of like, here's the process for how to do this thing. It's like, no, here's like the four steps that I take if I'm doing this thing. Like if I'm writing an article, here are the four steps that I take. If I'm adding a lesson to a course that I teach, here are the like three steps that I take. Like it's, I'm always trying to break it down into very simple, but very replicable. So I don't have to think about the process. All I have to think about is being creative. And I think a lot of times with creative people, we think like, oh, I don't want to be like stymied by having like rigid processes and systems. Like I'm not that type of person. But I think that that's wrong, because I think that if we do set like ways to work, then it frees us up to only have to focus on the creative stuff.
Yeah.
Which is what we, that's kind of what we all want to do anyways, right?
Absolutely.
So I think having those kind of things in place that are easy to follow, that are easy to replicate, that we just kind of have to look at it and be like, okay, this is the step I'm at. This is the thing that I'm doing. Then it just becomes so much easier to just be like, I'm free to create at this moment.
That makes a whole lot of sense. You know, when you create that container to work within where the steps are just right there in front of you, you're right. You can be more creative and you can spend more time on the things you love doing. I really appreciate you saying that. Real quickly, how often are you kind of going back and reassessing in your own business those expenses and, you know, that bottom line number?
Yeah, typically once a month, usually, like at a quick, like 5 minutes, not like I'm going to spend a day looking at it. And then at the end of the year, I usually just look like, have I spent more this year or less this year? And if I've spent more, why did I spend more? Sometimes there's a good reason.
Yeah.
Sometimes like this last year, I've had to do so much writing. So my biggest expense was editing. And like, I love that the biggest expense in my business is hiring other freelancers. I feel actually really good about that. And I'm like, okay, this makes sense because I had to do a whole lot of writing around, and I'm not even talking about the book. I'm talking about writing things that kind of relate to the book and promote the book. And like, this is what was required. So that makes sense. But maybe I spent like double on software. And like, how much software do I really, like, I am a tech person, but still like, I use Google Docs, which are free for the majority of things. I use spreadsheets, which are free. I don't need that much software. So sometimes I can get kind of caught up and be like, oh, this software was like 80% off if I buy like 4 years. But like, do I really need that? Sometimes it's no. Other than my mailing list. My mailing list, I think, is my biggest software expense every month. And that I know I need, because something like 95, 96% of the revenue in my business is generated from newsletters. Yeah. So I know that spending a couple $100 on MailChimp a month kind of makes sense, because that's what generates the money moving forward.
Yeah. I'm like you. I have a bookkeeper that does my books, and every month when I get the report, I do take a look through, particularly, I look at the income, of course, but I look at the expenses because I want to see if we have any leaks, you know, where we can, because if we are spending money without thinking about it, that's coming out of my own pocket. You know, my business is not large. So anyhow, I agree with you taking a quick look each month. And then we do the same where, you know, at the end of the year, we look at where we spent money and where we might be able to curb some costs for the following year. So that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that with us.
No worries.
So going back to this knowing you're enough, I think you gave an example of, was it the course you were trying to create where it was like 30? You had this vision for like a massive course with lots of technology to it, and you streamlined it down. Could you tell that story to our audience?
Yeah. So the very first course, the online course that I created, was called Creative Class, and it teaches freelancers the business of freelancing. There's a lot of systems and processes. You can tell that's something I really care about. The idea for it was because I know how to make software, I'm like, well, I can make some course software. And I was like, well, maybe it can be 30 lessons. Like maybe it can be like just really in-depth and detailed. And like, as I was planning it out and thinking about it, I was like, well, it's going to take like 5 or 6 months to like make the software, and then like 5 or 6 months to record 30 lessons. And then like all of this time to make this, because I'm creative. So I have this like big vision for this thing that I want to do. And I was like, wait a second, like this doesn't make sense. Like I've never launched and taught an online course before. So why am I going to spend like a year or more creating something when I don't even know if it's going to work? So yeah. I was like, okay, I'm just going to pare all of it down. So I'm going to use software that exists. There's like a gazillion WordPress plugins for course software. So I just picked one. I'm like, okay, maybe I just teach 7 lessons. Like, what are the lessons that I have to teach where if I didn't teach them, the whole process would just fall apart? Mm-hmm. So I picked 7 instead of 30, which took a lot less time. And yes. I was able to launch it in a few months. And I think the biggest lesson that I got from that was there's launching is kind of an iterative process where you don't launch something once and then you're done. Yeah. I think the first time you launch, you're guessing at most things. You're guessing at how you're positioning it. You're guessing at how it'll be received by your audience. You're guessing at the price point. You're guessing at a whole lot of things. But then once you've launched it the first time, then you've got data. Then you can look like, did this work? Did this not? Is the type of person buying it the type of person that I thought? If not, maybe I can change the messaging. And then the other thing that I learned was with those 7 lessons, I started asking people who went through them, saying like, what do you think was missing? What did you want to learn that you thought you were going to learn, but you didn't learn? Mm-hmm. And then from that, I got a whole bunch of data and I saw trends in that there was, I think there's 5 or 6 lessons that people were like, I wish I knew this. And I could see that coming up over and over again. So I made those lessons after I launched, after it was making money, after I tested it in the market. And those lessons, those additional lessons became way more popular than the first 7 anyways, because yeah. I was listening to not just everybody, but I was listening to the audience of people who had opened up their wallets to buy the thing from me. And those are the type of people that I wanted, because they're the type of people who were willing to be customers. And so, yeah, it was just such a like learning experience in terms of like, it's easier. Like, we all want to launch like the next biggest thing, but I think mm-hmm. it's faster and easier and better if we launch small at first, iterate, and then grow it slowly based on the market and based on customers, instead of just guessing at every single thing right in the beginning.
I love that you said that. We, you know, in the product world, we often recommend that people do smaller runs when they're mm-hmm. releasing a new product category. Because again, to your point, you want to test the market and make sure that there's a demand for this and an interest in it. You don't want to invest heavily in this inventory. You know, it's a little different with software than it is with physical goods. You don't want a storage room full of product or your, you know, kitchen table full of product that you don't know whether or not it's going to sell. So in that same vein that you just described, we can do that in the product world too, in different ways. And I love how you talked about surveying your audience and asking follow-up questions for how you can improve things, because mm-hmm. I agree with you, whether we're providing products or services, we can constantly be improving upon what we're already doing. And if we're serving our audience even better, then they're going to want to keep coming back for more from us, right?
Yeah, I don't want to, like, there's a lot of businesses, especially online businesses, that rely on just rapid acquisition to make money yes. every month. And I've always thought that seems a little silly and short-sighted, because you just need so much volume to make that work. Yeah. And it's cheaper, faster, and easier to just keep selling to the same people. Yeah. Like, more than half the people that buy one thing from me buy more than one thing from me. And I think something like 20% of people buy all of the things.
We love those people.
Yeah, those are the best people. And like, I know those people. Like, if I see those people,
you have relationships. Yeah,
exactly. Like, I recognize their names. Like, I've had conversations with them on email. Like, that's the kind of business that I want to run, where I'm constantly serving the same user base, because that's the user base I know. That's the user base I like. That's the user base I enjoy having conversations with and learning from and talking to. Yeah. And that's the user base that helps me, because in talking to them, I can see what they want. I can see what they need. I can see how they describe the things that I do. Because even when I'm doing something as granular as writing a sales page, the way that I would pitch a product that I'm an expert in because I made it is very different than how it should be described to somebody who might want to buy it. Yeah. So I'm always looking for like verbal or written cues from people who are buying the product and how they describe it and how they describe the value, because that's the language that I want to use when I'm pitching that product.
Absolutely. I agree with you wholeheartedly. We do a lot of that too, where we listen to how people are talking about the things that we're talking about and, you know, the verbiage there. So how do you define success in your business now, and how has this changed over the years for you?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, when I started in my 20s, I was kind of dumb.
Like, we all were, right? Yeah, I mean, no offense to any of our listeners in your 20s, but I'm much different now than I was then.
Exactly. So I was like, well, I think a successful business person makes $1 million a year. So I'm going to try to make $1 million a year. But like that number came out of nowhere. Like I pulled that number out of the sky. Like it wasn't, it didn't mean anything. Like it was just, I think a lot of times we just make these fake goals for ourselves. We set these artificial targets for the sake of setting artificial targets. And then these numbers or these targets or goals function as a source of unnecessary stress, mm-hmm. which is what happened for me until I abandoned it because I was like, well, why do I need $1 million? And there was absolutely no, still don't know why I would need $1 million a year. Right. And so I abandoned it. And I was just like, well, how much do I actually need? Like, unless there is kind of like an upper bounds, then nothing is enough. Mm-hmm. Unless there's upper bounds, then we basically just keep going after all of it forever, everything in perpetuity, which doesn't, it just doesn't make sense to me. So I started to think about, well, how much is enough?
Yeah.
And that was kind of like, I mean, that's kind of the point of the book.
Right. Which I loved. Keep continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No worries. But yeah, that's kind of like, once I started to think about that, well, like, what do I need? Like, what do I need to have a comfortable, simple life? Like, mm-hmm. what do I need to be able to cover all my bases, put money in the savings and take care of my family? And like past that, if I don't have a good reason for making more or working more, why do I want to?
Yeah.
Like if there's not a good reason for that, then I'd rather like go for a hike or bike ride or travel or like do something not working. Mm-hmm. And I think in thinking about that, I think that that's really the antithesis of like unchecked growth or like bad capitalism. if we don't question in our business, like how much is enough? How will we know when we've reached it and what'll change if we do? Because if we don't start to think about those things, a lot of growth is based on ego. So I think we need ego in the beginning because we think we can do something better than what exists in the market. So we create a product, we start a business. And I think that's great. I think that it's a good reason for a lot of people to start a business because they think they can do better. And a lot of times it can. But mm-hmm. where ego can kind of get in the way is when we think, well, my business needs to be bigger to matter, or my business needs to be bigger because it needs to seem like it needs to seem better when I talk about it at like a dinner party or something like that. But I don't know, like, does that do you want to have a business that you're running and scaling so it looks good to other people? Or do you want to have a business that you actually enjoy running that gives you the lifestyle that you want, or that serves your existing customers well, or that actually thinks about things like what are the maintenance costs or obligations to opportunities or doing more in your business?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I read your book in like 2 days flat. It was over the Christmas break while I was also strategic planning for my business for 2019. And I made a whole list of all the things we offer. We have courses, we have conferences we host. I do coaching programs. We've got a lot that we provide for free and also paid programs. And I went through, well, I took your enough concept and I kind of did it in multiple ways. I looked at the programming we offer and what's really truly serving our audience. And I decided to cut a lot of things because they either weren't serving our audience, or they were taking up too much time for my team and I, or they weren't exciting me and firing me up anymore. So, you know, I think you need to kind of look at the holistic of the time commitment, the excitement level, the revenue it brings into the business and the profitability. And then whether it's serving your audience too, of course. So we made some changes based on that, based upon what I read in your book. And then, but what really resonated with me was the financial enough. And I'm not sure if you know, but I have 4 small children. My oldest just turned 9. And I feel like I have kind of been on this rat race of growth, you know, like we just constantly want to see, you know, year over year growth and this and that and the other. And I stopped and I said, you know what? Like, no, like what is my enough? So I sat down with my husband and we truly looked at what do we need to live a comfortable lifestyle and make sure that the kids can do all the fun things they want to do. And we can also pay for braces and all the things we need to pay for, you know, while at the same time giving us the freedom, the flexibility and more time that the reasons I built this business on a personal level for my family, you know? So mm-hmm. I think your concept of enough is 1, brilliant, but 2, it can be applied to so many things. It can be applied to the number crunching that we do within our business. It could be applied to the products and services that we offer. It can be applied to the team that we choose to have or not to have, you know? And so I want to thank you because I thought that that was a really strong message that came through, and it was very powerful in different ways for different aspects of running my business.
Awesome. I'm glad that resonated. And you brought up such a good point, is that most of us start our business because we want to have the freedom to make decisions and to spend more time with our family or to do more things outside of work. Mm-hmm. And then we get into the weeds with our businesses, and then we end up running it the same way as the like corporate job that we had that we quit right. or like the startup that we were working at or things like that. And it's just like, if we think back to like, well, why did I start this in the first place? Like, yeah. was it to spend more time with my family during the day? Was it to travel more? And it's like, if it's not lining up with that, then we have the ability a lot of the times to make changes. And yeah. I think to your point about enough being so useful for every aspect, I'll share one story about that yeah. that has nothing to do, because a lot of times people think about like the financial thing. And I know because I talk about that a lot in the book, because it's something I yeah. think about a lot too. But even for things like mailing lists, even for things like communicating with an audience. So my mailing list needed to grow from zero to something, because that's how I knew that I wanted to generate revenue, because I'm a mm-hmm. content creator, basically. But if my mailing list grew past the size that it's at, like if it's at 30,000 odd people now and it grew to like 300,000 or 3 million, I wouldn't be able to have I send an email every Sunday and I get typically 150, 250 replies. Mm-hmm. And I can read all those emails. Like right. I can, like part of my job is talking to my audience directly, and I'm lucky that I have the ability to do that. So I can read those emails. I can reply. It's only a couple hundred. I can reply to them all in about half a day. But mm-hmm. if it was 10 times that or 100 times that, yeah. I wouldn't know my audience anymore. Like I wouldn't know how to make products. I wouldn't know how to run my business very well. So if focusing on, like I needed to focus on growth to get it to a point where it could generate enough revenue to support my business mm-hmm. and myself. But past that, like I don't need to focus on growing my list anymore, because it's at a size where it's enough. It's at a size where I can do the thing that I want to do, which is communicate with people. Like it's not a no reply at Paul Jarvis. It's like my personal email that goes directly right. to my inbox. Yeah. So it just makes sense to consider enough in like every aspect of your business.
Yeah, I actually put a post-it note on my computer that says, is this necessary? Is it enough? And, you know, just to remind myself as I'm making decisions, is this something that drives us towards our goals? Earlier this year, I did a podcast episode where I talked about the three phases of business. And one of them is growth, because I agree with you. Every business has to go through growth periods, yes. right? That's how we stay innovative and keep things fresh and new. And I also feel like the other two phases we all go through is a like maintenance mode where we're optimizing things and building those systems and processes like you mentioned. And then there's the streamlining. And that's kind of where we're pulling back on things that aren't working anymore or don't fit with the product line or what, you know, like the things that just don't fit with what we've mm-hmm. built now. And it seems to me that you kind of feel those three are necessary too in all phases. You know, we kind of run through those different phases at different times of our business.
For sure. I think it takes a very different mindset to shift from growth to like post enough. And mm-hmm. I think that if we don't have those upper bounds, or if we don't stop and consider what is enough, then we never leave the growth phase, because we all have to start in that phase.
Yeah.
But if we don't think about it and get introspective about it, then we never leave. And that's where a lot of businesses are at. They're like, well, growth worked in the beginning because I went from zero to something. So now I just have to go from something to something more to something. And it's mm-hmm. like, it's never ending. So I think that that's right. really smart to think about it in terms of phases, because it's what's needed. Like I run my business very different when I'm optimizing for enough than when I'm working to build to enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. All right, so what is your favorite business tool or resource or a book other than your own that has helped build your business to what it is now?
MailChimp, 100%. And it doesn't even, I don't even care if people use MailChimp or ConvertKit or Drip or whatever, but like having an email newsletter has been the most useful part of my business. And even people I know that run businesses that sell physical products or have like volume, having a mailing list mm-hmm. is such a great way to directly communicate with your audience in a place that they actually pay attention. Nobody yeah. pays attention to their Facebook or Twitter feeds anymore. But when they get an email, they look at it. Yeah. That's where people's attention are, is their inbox. So fostering a direct connection with your audience through a newsletter, I just think is so benefit. I mean, I can say that because my business runs off my mailing list, but
yeah,
like a lot of businesses can and really do.
I think it's about making sure you're building. I see a lot of people that are overwhelmed by doing emails. I think they don't know what to say. They don't know how frequently to send them, particularly in the physical product. They don't want to come off as salesy and they don't want to over email their audience. Yeah. But I agree with you. I think that if you're looking at it as a tool for communicating with your audience, for sharing what you're working on, for adding value. And I know that that phrase is used so often that it kind of becomes obsolete. But truly, if you're, you know, giving your audience things that they're interested in, you're providing value. And so how are you doing that consistently and creating a conversation with them? So I love that.
I don't know. I don't even know how to sell. I'm like the worst salesperson ever. Right. But because I'm in constant communication with my list is called the Sunday Dispatches. So it makes sense. I send an email every Sunday. It's an article every week. Once or twice a year, I mention a product that I have or a book that I've written, and I don't even need to sell those things because I've had a line of communication open with them. I'm just like, hey, you know me, you know what I'm about, what I'm talking about. Here's a thing I made. Check it out if you want. If not, that's cool too.
Yeah. Because you're building a relationship just through email, even if you don't know them individually one by one, all 30,000 of them, you are getting to know many of them on a personal level too. Yeah. Cool. Well, where can people connect with you online and buy your book?
Yeah, so I'm not really on any social network. I guess I'm on Twitter, but that's mostly for sarcasm. it's my newsletter. Like my newsletter, Sunday Dispatches, pjrbs.com, or just Google Paul Jarvis because nobody can remember that URL. And then the book is called Company of One, Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business. And that's available on Amazon, in any bookstore that you can find it. It's traditionally published, so it has distribution. So you should be able to find it everywhere that English nonfiction books are sold. It'll be coming out, I think, in 6 or 7 other languages, but that takes a really long time. So that's not for a little while.
Well, congrats to you. That's awesome. You guys, I've read the book. It is amazing. I mean, my husband read it too, and he's not an entrepreneur and he loved it. And so I really encourage you to go get the book. We will include Paul's links to his newsletter and to the book in the show notes here if you want to grab those easily. But Paul, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for sharing your philosophies and your take on how we can truly make our businesses fit the lifestyle and the structure and the format that we want, you know, and I think more people need to be talking about that. So I thank you for writing this book and for coming on today.
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time chatting about this today.
Thanks, Paul.
Proof to Product is brought to you by Trade Show Bootcamp and hosted by me, Katie Hunt. Since 2011, TSBC has worked with hundreds of product-based businesses to help them up-level, scale, and build profitable, sustainable companies. You can find our show notes and additional resources at prooftoproduct.com. And if you like what you heard today, please head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star review and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode.